Oline, and savvy regards to the staff at NEMADA. This is the main professor recording on the 5th of August, 2021. For the Terma and the Turton, that is room 17 at the school. And the subject of this talk is the launch of the Treasure Ark. As you know, I use 17 as the meeting room where we occasionally gather so that I can talk about some matters that are of intimate personal concern to me. And specifically at this moment, it concerns a project underway here at Hag House in Galicia in northern Spain to pack up my library and archives. To give you a picture of what's involved, it's looking like the result of this exercise of sorting files, discarding a lot of printed material and redundant material and so forth, will result in the materials that go into the hold of the Treasure Ark. And that would be, as far as I can see right now, about 110 boxes of books. All the boxes are of the same size. They're 30 by 40 by 40 in metric. And they all weigh about between 22 and 24 kilos, which is something around 45 to 50 pounds. So 110 boxes, 5 clear plastic containers with files in them, and 4 other black and white plastic coffers with files in them. So all in all, 9 boxes, they're not cardboard boxes, they're plastic containers of files, old manuscripts, documents, wide variety of contents. And that in totality looks to be what I'm going to have stacked up here in the garage right on the other side of this wall when I complete this task. Let me start out by telling you the purpose of this task. For some time now, I've been considering how to move this little operation at Hag House to another location. So that would involve one day getting in the car, which would be packed with certain items, and there would be a roof rack with certain things on top, and driving out of here to someplace else. So the passengers on that journey would be 2 anthropines, 1 feline, and 1 canine. The need and the desire to be somewhere else has been growing, and it's impossible to say right now when or even if we will move from here, but I certainly hope that the opportunities to do so, or the right opportunity to do so, reveals itself in the near future. We came here on March 12th. Of 2017, around the time that I initiated the Mandela Effect Decoded channel. So that's 4.5 years we've been in this place. It's a huge place, although it's 100 euros cheaper than my little house in Gaussin, Turton Towers. It has, I don't know, 6 bedrooms, 4 baths, And downstairs, which is about halfway underground where I work, it has the largest office space I've ever had, plus the garage next door, which has room to store a lot of things, and a place under the stairs where most of the book boxes, or 65 of them, have been stored over these years. So living in this place, at this outpost, has given me the opportunity to arrange a lot of things, and it's now giving me the opportunity to pack the hold of the treasure ark. I'm doing that because when we leave here, I won't be taking any of it with me. So recently, thanks to a visit from the loyal Spaniels down in Alicante, been able to work out what to do with that collection. So there's no problem regarding storing it. We have a couple of excellent options for storing it here in Spain for the interim, whatever that interim would be. So it will be secure and safe. And with that task completed, I can cut loose and we will be free to drive out of here one day with a few things that I'm carefully selecting, some files that I need to take with me so that I can continue with the immediate projects I have in mind and continue, of course, with any activity relevant to Nemeta. As I mentioned to the Spaniels, this is, I think, the fourth time I've gone through this exercise of packing and shipping, or packing and storing. The first time would have been in the fall of 91. So what's that, 30 years ago? I've been doing this for 30 years. And I've shipped those books and that collection, which of course has grown over the years, from one place to another. Now, of course, I'm not shipping them anywhere. I'm putting them into storage. And the question remains, where will they ultimately go? So to use the nautical analogy, you could say that I'm packing the hold of the treasure ark, ARK, which you see in the image of the goldfish. And it's all ready to sail. But where will it sail and where will it land? So you can imagine that it's packed and it's sitting in the water, moored to a dock, which is the storage facility. And then when the time comes and the tide rises to take it somewhere, it will be taken where it goes next. Obviously, there is no way to know if I will be around or if I will be able to be present at that future location where the ark lands and where the collection can be then unloaded and ideally taken out and put on display so that all the library is available. And in that case, the collection would find its future home, its refuge, in some place that ideally would also have space for tables and corners of study so that students in the future could come and delve into this material and benefit from it in some way or another. This exercise, which I hope to complete in a week or so, is therefore a large undertaking for practical and logistic purposes, right? I have to cut loose from that simply because I can't take it with me going to leave here, and I don't want to. But this undertaking also has a symbolic meaning. And it's been, I've been observing myself as I am going through this, through these chores of sorting and packing away. Sorting, filing, packing. For instance, every time I put books into a box, I remember those books. I remember my experiences with them, places and the times when they were my intimate friends, and in some cases, my only friends. And so when I have a book in hand and I place it in the box, I'm conscious that I may never take it out of that box, but someone will. I'm confident of that. And I have no concern. I'm not worried about the future of the collection, as I'm calling it. I used to call it the Ambergain Trust. So I trust that this collection will be preserved and that it will be eventually, what's the word I'm looking for? That in the future there will be those who take responsibility for seeing that it can be available to the world. That, of course, requires the right location. And I strongly desire that location be the final location. It would just be too much to ship these books from one place to another in the world. They need to go now to their final destination. And when the tide rises and the currents pick up the ark, that's where it will be going, according to my intentions. So, I entrust the Ambergain Trust to those who step forward and are willing to take responsibility for it. And I know that you are, each and all of you, in your own way, willing to do that, whether you take part in the actual logistics or not. I know that you support my wish for the journey of the treasure ark. As I was saying, I don't feel that I'm losing anything. I'm not concerned about the possibility of not opening these boxes myself and being involved in setting the collection up in its future home. In fact, I'm relieved. It has been an unusual privilege to have this place where I had everything on hand. So typically, if I was composing a unit for Nemeta, I would be able to find a book or find some files that might be relevant to that work I've done in the past that stands in continuity with the activities of the school at the current moment. And all that has been wonderful. But actually, I don't need any of that. I don't need to be able to walk across the room and reach out and put my hand on one of those books and open it exactly to the page that I remember that refers to something that I'm writing in a unit for Nemeta. Don't have to do that anymore. And I'm looking forward to seeing how I operate independently of access to these materials. It's going to be a good thing for me. It's going to be a good development. It is a good development for me. So I'm quite happy about this undertaking, and I feel serene and confident day by day as I tackle it, and it's quite an enormous task. But on the subject of happiness, I'd like to say a few words that might be appealing to you. As I recall my life, I don't find that happiness was ever a concern for me through a good part of my life. And there were moments when I was, there were long periods when I was quite unhappy. On the other hand, I was not necessarily inwardly unhappy. Sure, I was unhappy with my circumstances and the limits that life put on me. No question about that. But being, as I am, privileged with the autistic condition, I always found an inner happiness, and I was always content to be alone with my studies and my projects. There is a kind of serenity within that state. It's an odd serenity, however. As you know, of course, it's a serenity that can be disturbed and perturbed and irritated by the most minor of influences. A button, a zipper, a noise. So, yes, high irritation comes with that condition. And the response to that irritation is often an infantile tantrum or a meltdown. And I've had my share of those. But looking back in retrospect and summing it all up, I would say that I did pretty well in holding to that deep and isolated inner serenity. I loved to live alone. I loved my solitude, and my solitude loved me, made me what I am. But happiness is another subject, and as I was saying, well, I never thought much about being happy. I didn't think that the goal of life was to be happy. I certainly never considered that. As a matter of fact, the issue of happiness only really came to the forefront of my attention quite late in my life. Most of the time through those years, it didn't bother me that I wasn't overtly or ostensibly happy. Of course, I was. I did have happy moments and happy experiences off and on, particularly in Santa Fe, where I had an ideal social environment. And I had an entourage in Santa Fe, I would say, of about 20 really good friends, 15 women and 5 men. And I was really happy to know them, and they were happy to know me. And so I enjoyed a certain kind of happiness in friendship. Friendship is really important to me. But I'm talking here about really deep inner happiness, the kind that, as far as I know in my experience, comes through realization of the transcendent. And I guess ultimately that was the only kind of happiness that mattered to me. And the moment that I saw that it mattered to me, the moment that I detected the prospect of a true and deep profound and enduring happiness was a precise moment. Perhaps I've talked about this before, I don't know. I think I might have alluded to it. So that moment occurred on a glorious summer day in 2008 in Ronda, Spain. And that was the Ronda moment. It so happens that the Ronda moment occurred just 18 days before August 8th, 2008, the day of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. So in those 18 days, I lived in an altered state, which turned out to be the prelude or setup for an even more powerful altered state, which began with the Terma. Now, I remember so well that I came back to my house, Turton Towers, below Gaussine, and I sat on the terrace. And I sat there off and on for those 18 days after the Ronda moment, savoring the sensation of a kind of happiness that I had never expected before. It was a really poignant sensation. I remember distinctly sitting there, looking out across the valley, out to the Straits of Gibraltar, looking across at the mountains of Africa, looking up at the sky with vultures wheeling in big spirals. And I remember the particular quality of that happiness. When it came, when it started to well up, something else came with it. There was a sense of resignation. I sat there and I reflected on a possibility that I might be facing, namely, that I might never be able to have a deep and genuine contact again with any other human being ever. And I reflected on that, which was a direct outcome of the Ronda moment, by the way. And I thought how curious it is that at the moment the true prospect of happiness would dawn in my life, I would also realize, well, yeah, I guess I'm ready, I guess I'm ripe, but how and if I will ever be able to share this happiness with anyone else is an unknown, was an unknown at that moment. It no longer is an unknown, but it was then, and I felt it acutely, and I resigned myself to the possibility that I would never be able to share it due to its vastness and due to its depth. So there was a big unknown in the factor of happiness that welled up after the Ronda moment. And there was no way to see ahead, no way to know how things would work out or how I would resolve that issue. Of course, I was in a tremendous meltdown at that time. And I can see now that the Rwanda moment, 18 days before the Terma, was the setup for the Terma. And then I went into an even deeper meltdown, in a state of ecstatic mania that ran for about 8 months after I got the Terma. And it was wild, because during those 8 months, I was thrashing around with this dilemma, this quandary. How am I going to get this out? How am I going to share this? How can I possibly tell anyone how wonderful this is? And even if I tell them, can they get it? So that was how it was back then. But that's not how it is today, thanks to you and others who are not on the staff of Nemeta, others who are out there in the world who've received the term of Gaia Awakening and found a way to place it in their life on their own terms. And there are some, possible to calculate how many. But I'm speaking exclusively to you right now to let you know that you are responsible for upholding this happiness that I've found. And I know that it's secure now. I'm not holding it simply by myself. You actually are holding my happiness. And how wonderful is that? Well, I can assure you that it liberates me, yours truthfully, who might possibly be the most liberated entity that you know already. But it liberates me even more. And this is something truly sublime. And I'm sure you agree that we together can all thank the goddess for that, because she's behind it all. She's always been behind it all. Not only for me in the developments of my life since I saw the witch on the roof at age 4, but she's behind it all for you as well, in every event of your life that you've lived, to bring you to her treasure, the Mother Lode. And just as the Diamond Sky Dakinis say, you cannot become anything but more beautiful. Well, this situation can only get better, irregardless of what happens in the world or how bad it gets for A10. For me, now, it seems increasingly probable that I can achieve something which I think is quite exceptional, and that would be to come out of autism just as she comes out of autism in correction. As far as I know, possibly that has happened, possibly in the many recorded and researched instances of natural autism. That has happened. I don't know. All I can say is it sure looks like it's happening to me. Wow. It's dazzling, really. And it suits me so well. You know, one thing that I love in life, one thing that I love about life is this. I love to change. I do. And when I look back at those moments in my life when I have changed, there are always specific moments, dramatic, thrilling moments, and they come back to me as LMMs. And to come out of this condition would be the ultimate change. You can see that, I think. My character is odd. I've looked very closely at the factors that come into play in the case of what is called an autist. And it seems to me that it's not merely that condition alone that determines the fate and character of the individual, but there are other factors. For instance, the disposition of interest. So generally speaking, someone in that condition will have a narrow band of interest, and often the interest will be trivial. So you find that autistics can remember things to an extraordinary degree, a paranormal level, and yet what they remember is trivial. Then in some cases, they are gifted with certain talents like photographic memory that allows them, say, to fly over London in a helicopter and then go back and draw in detail everything that they saw, but that's all they can do. So generally, routinely, autism is limited to a narrow band of interest. Not my case, obviously. The other factor in the composition of the character of an autist is their basic human nature. I do believe that human animals are born with a basic human nature. For instance, there are different traits of personality and character that are somehow present innately, and then they develop early in childhood. So you can take any human animal, autistic or not, and you can look at their profile, and it becomes obvious that they are innately endowed with certain personal attributes and qualities. For instance, aggression or sadness or a need to caretake other people or need to dominate or need to be dominated. And so there is the factor of basic human nature to take into consideration. And my basic nature is sweet and amiable. And that was odd for me from an early age because the condition is antisocial. How to deal with that? I have a strong antisocial bearing, an independence from any need for human contact. if you take it to its extreme, and that's exactly what it is, an indifference to sharing and communicating with others. But at the same time, my basic human nature compelled me toward communication and toward enjoyment of the company of other people. But you know, of course, that enjoyment is a two-way street. And I can assure you that there are many times in the past when I did reach out, acting on my basic human nature, and I found that those who were there to receive it didn't actually enjoy me. And that was really troubling to me. We are all autistic children of the world mother. And the more that you love and learn what she offers, the more you become like an autistic yourself. You acquire a deepening power of concentration. That's the way it goes, especially with your mutation of A11. You could say her purpose in that mutation is to produce her special brood of autistic children. And I can assure you that recognition of brilliance is great. I really don't mind, but it's of secondary importance to me. The primary importance is to be enjoyed. That matters to me now. And it's a factor in my happiness. And of course, it is a positive contributing factor because I know that I am enjoyed. That's all I ever wanted. And while I had it off and on to various degrees in the past, I wouldn't deny that at all. I remember those moments and those men and women in my life with great affection. Nothing compared to the way I have it now. And I have you to thank for that. In some cases, we've met in the actual 4D, as I call it. And in some cases, we've only met in the virtual or through the virtual. But nevertheless, meeting through the virtual is an actual event, isn't it? And in all those instances, I've come to find enjoyment in a way that I never knew it before. For instance, I know that you all know that basically I'm pretty funny. Although I didn't smile for most of my life, and I don't have smile lines, I am learning to smile. But above and beyond that, I love to laugh. And laughter is, what can I say? What is laughter for the Nahual? It's kind of like a massage, a really, really deep and pleasurable massage. So yeah, we have our laughs. We've had some, and there's more to come. So anyway, that's about what I have to say. My purpose here is to leave you with the visualization of the treasure ark. I'm loading the hold. And once it's loaded, it's in the water, it's safely moored, until the time comes when the tide rises and the currents take it to its future and final destination. Steady as she goes.